Hello, everyone. Before we jump into this series, I just wanted to say a few words about something that I'm offering you that is very, very connected to the content of this series. So if you listen to one or hopefully all four of these next episodes, you will see that we dig deeply into how we as Latter-day Saint families can become stronger, how we can become stronger parents to our children, and how we can become more able to adapt to the differences and the ways that people are growing here in and around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in our own families. Because I'm so interested in this, I have more to offer you. So since this is a brand new thing that I'm doing, I want to orient you about the program that I have been rolling out in 2024. So here we go. Okay, so beginning in 2024, I am creating a library of hour-long-ish online courses, each focused on important topics relevant to our faith expansion journey. So my vision for this is that within the next couple of years, I am going to have a growing but ever enlarging library of online classes. So just to give you some examples of classes that I have either produced or that I have in preparation, I am working on some classes on marriage, where one partner is more traditional and the other partner is more nuanced. I have up my sleeve, and there have been many recommendations that I create some content on how to teach the Strength of the Youth manual to your adolescents in a psychologically healthy way. I have a class planned on teaching the importance of mindfulness and meditation in the context of LDS faith expansion. And I also have been thinking about doing some classes on helping us better understand the psychological impact of Ezra Taft Benson's To the Mothers in Zion talk. So these are just some examples. Each month, I'm going to be rolling out a new topic and a new class. I literally have so many ideas, I don't even know how I'm going to narrow them down, which is a really good problem. I'm definitely going to be creating detailed presentations for all of the content that I do in my year-long intensive group healing works. This curriculum that I've already created has been so incredibly healing for so many people that I want to make it available to more of you, and to perhaps some of you who want to know what we're doing in the groups before you join them. And sometimes people that are in the groups would like to have more robust content or like a booklet, which brings me to my next point. So the way that I am going to be creating this library is this. I'm going to be doing a live webinar called my Latter-day Solutions series. This is going to happen one Wednesday every month. It's usually towards the beginning of the month. This event will be synchronous. It'll be on Zoom, and I will be presenting some of this beautiful content in the format of a formal presentation, which I'm talking like a PowerPoint with all of my talking points. And also included in this will be reflection questions, journal prompts, and a beautiful digital workbook that you will have access to just a couple of days after the event. So you can attend the event. If you attend the presentation live, you'll be able to participate in an anonymous question and response session at the end of each presentation. So if you are there, jot your questions down, put them in the chat, and one of my assistants and I will work through and answer all of your questions that will then be a part of this presentation recording. But your face will not be on the screen, so don't worry about that. These will be anonymous questions. Each and every one of these classes will be recorded and packaged as classes on my website for your future purchase and enjoyment. When you purchase either a seat at the live event or a class that has been recorded, the recording and the digital workbook will be yours forever. One of the reasons why I'm doing this is because I've had so many people say that they write pages and pages of notes on the content of the podcast. And what I'm trying to do is actually do some of that work for you by creating presentations that you can just jump into and take a look at these digital workbooks with all of the outlines and everything that I'm talking about these specific topics from this Latter-day Solutions series. And I want to tell you that the content that I do for these series is deep, deep stuff. It's a lot of work that I do, and I really, really go deeply into explaining it and laying it out and giving you opportunities to really dig deep into your own inquiry process as you reflect and journal. The content is amazing, and also I must say the workbooks are amazing, although I have nothing to do with the design of them, but I have cool people that I have helping me do those. The first 3 months of 2024, I have been focusing on strengthening our families as we grow in faith expansion. January of 2024's class was about shifting away from a beliefs-based parenting model, which most of us did when we were more Orthodox. So we're shifting away from a beliefs-based parenting model and towards a model that privileges teaching our children values over specific beliefs. It was a wonderful, beautiful class. I am super proud of it, and I know that the people who have attended it and have purchased it so far have given me just amazing feedback. February of 2022's class focused on expanding our worldview in our family culture and how crucial it is that we broaden our identity. So many of us early on, when we're more traditionally believing, kind of live under the identity as members of the church, and we really have a pretty small worldview. And the entire class there in February is my helping people better understand how exactly to move from a one pillar paradigm, which is sort of a church only paradigm, to a multiple pillar paradigm of truth and light, basically helping us all see that we can find truth throughout the traditions of the world, throughout time. And it's not only helping us better understand ourselves and how we were raised with sort of a limited worldview, but it helps us shift how to be parents and how to be humans and partners, where we're basically expanding our horizons. What I'm trying to do in each and every one of these classes, as you probably know, if you hang out with me, is I'm always trying to raise our levels of consciousness. And I'm doing that in a very specific way in this class. Now, in March, on March 7th, 2024, that is upcoming, I will be presenting some amazing content to families adjusting to living in mixed belief homes. I will be talking about some of the common myths out there about raising children in multiple belief homes. I will be talking about many types of multiple belief families, because there are many here in the Latter-day Saint space. And I'm going to also talk about how each and every one of these constellations has potential strengths and vulnerabilities depending on the maturity of each partner. I'll also be talking about how faith expansion in family life sometimes exposes already existing vulnerabilities in one's marriage and family, but that this is not necessarily, this doesn't mean this is that all is lost. It just means that faith expansion offers marriages and families an opportunity to grow in ways that possibly they never have grown before. It really exposes some of our weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and we can look at those head on and grow as families. Finally, in this March 7th class, I will be offering some principles, some basic principles to parents that they might consider when parenting children in a multiple belief family setting. Not only will you have a chance to get your questions answered at the end of each presentation, but purchasing each Latter-day Solutions live class before it is recorded is going to cost you less, because I want to encourage people to show up and participate in this live event. It's much more fun to talk to human beings than to talk to a computer screen. And also, I want your great questions. So basically, by attending live, you'll be getting your answers to your questions and you'll get a better value. Although I will say I am trying to make these classes very affordable because I care deeply about our community and I want nothing to be cost prohibitive. So jump over to LatterdayStruggles.com to purchase a seat to attend my upcoming Latter-day Solutions live class, March 7th, 2024. And you can check out the library of the two classes that have already been recorded with beautiful workbooks. And sometimes I even offer little bundles. So see what kind of deals I have going on there. Now, without further ado, let's jump into this beautiful series, because in this series, we are talking about how to strengthen relationships between parents and their young adult disaffiliated children. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal series. And I couldn't be more proud of it. And I am completely honored and blown away by the individual friend and colleague who you are going to get to meet right now. So let's jump in. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles. This is your host, Valerie. And I am pleased and excited to have my good friend and colleague here with me again today. Hello, I'm Liz McDonald. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am very well. So Liz and I are halfway through a four-part series exploring some incredibly important and interesting research that Liz has done over the last couple of years. And we are halfway through tackling this topic. Liz, will you share the topic? Well, first of all, share the title of your research paper and the topic. Kind of give us a big broad overview of why you did this research and what it's about. And then we'll dive into the specific portion of the research that we have planned to talk about today.
For sure. So the title of the paper that I wrote is The Impact of Religious Rigidity Exploring Conflict Between Parents and Young Adult Children Disaffiliating from the LDS Church. It's kind of a mouthful. I was doing a lot of work with parents, teaching parenting classes and doing parent coaching, and noticing a lot of conflict between parents and particularly emerging adults. That was what I was noticing, was between parents and emerging adults and even adolescents around what I consider to be really healthy normative differentiation processes, meaning the point in time when our kiddos realize that they are not us and we are not them and start to pursue their own identity and their own way of being in the world. And that conflict was really interesting to me because within this religious context of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the conflict looks, it looked to me like it had quite a specific flavor. And I saw just a lot of harm being done on the part of the children, that they were really, really suffering and being wounded by what they were getting from their parents, by their parents' kind of disproportionate, I would say, reactions. And because I know a lot of these parents and was working directly with them and hearing about how anxious they were and how difficult it was for them to parent their children through a disaffiliation, I know that the intentions were good and that they wanted to maintain connection in ways that they were not able to do, clearly. I believe that when people can do well, they will. And so I saw this as sort of a, oh, well, like, what's missing here? Maybe if they understood more of what was happening for people who are going through the process of disaffiliation, which can be very painful and disorienting for the person experiencing it, maybe these parents could be set up to at least do no harm and maybe offer support and connection through the process.
Thank you so much for that overview, Liz. What we're going to do today is we are going to dig deeper into the actual research that Liz did and what she learned from these 15 subjects that she interviewed. These were 15 young people between the ages of, I think it was 21 and 29. Is that correct, Liz?
Right.
And she basically just asked them very four very vague questions with the intent of just learning. The kind of research that Liz did is called a grounded theory study. And what that means is she comes to this question without having any preconceived notions of what the answer needs to be. It's really sort of an open field. She doesn't do a lit review. She doesn't do any research to precede the asking of these questions because the idea is that she just simply wants to see what these people have to say. And she starts noticing, well, what happens is she takes these interviews, she then has the interviews transcribed, and then she starts going through the interviews and starts noticing if any specific themes emerge, if anything is being said over and over and over again. And as a researcher, specifically of this type, when you're a researcher and you start hearing themes, it kind of gets exciting because you start noticing that perhaps you are striking on a phenomenon that helps you better understand the nature of this particular population. What Liz found that I was completely intrigued by is in this research process that she was in, she came up with, well, she noticed that what these subjects were saying was incredibly, not only was it remarkable, interesting, and heartbreaking, but all of the subjects were saying basically the same thing over and over and over again. She came up with four themes that these themes were repeated in almost every single one of the interviews. Three of the themes, she found 100% consistency between all 15 of the subjects, which is mind-blowing in the world of qualitative research. And the fourth theme, she found 80% of these participants consistently had the experience of this fourth topic that we're going to be discussing. So, Liz, what I'd like for you to do today, just very briefly, because again, we always ask everybody to go back and listen, just ever so briefly, touch on the first three themes that we've already tackled together today or in the last couple of episodes. And then we're going to hit the fourth theme. And then we're going to have a lot of fun just talking about some of the phenomenon and psychology behind what you learned from these research participants.
Yes. So the first theme that you were mentioning that had 100% saturation was parents who, according to their children's perceptions of them, it's important to say that obviously I didn't interview the parents. This is all coming from their children, their adult children. Parents who were disconnected from themselves, meaning that a lot of their values and the ways that they were spending their time had been kind of outsourced, according to these children, to the institution of the church. These parents were also disconnected from others, which is sort of the inevitable result of di being disconnected from yourself, that you can only, we have a, I think, sort of a straight line in terms of like, if I'm this connected to myself, I can be this connected to other people. If I don't know myself at all, it's very, very difficult for me to truly get to know other people in an authentic way. And they were also disconnected from the present moment, from, I'm going to say, from this life in some ways, that they were caught between regret about the past and sort of worry and anxiety about the future and this eternal family, which was being broken, or the plan that was sort of being thwarted by a child leaving the church. The second theme was that we talked about was a conditional construct of worthiness and love, meaning that these children perceived that there were certain aspects of themselves which were unworthy of love and belonging and acceptance. And they went to varying degrees to hide this, these aspects of themselves. They sensed, I think, in many ways accurately, what would be approved of and what would not be approved of, and then struggled to navigate what does that, how does that affect how they're showing up at home, and how does that drive a wedge between their real sense of themselves and this projection that they've created, or this false self that they're presenting for love and approval, within the context of their families or their communities. And that was a real source of pain for these subjects. Or the last theme with 100% saturation was the certainty of the worldview that's held by the parents. And that's, this idea of like orthodoxy, which just means correct ideas or right ideas. And this rigidity or certainty led to a variety of things, including a really low, I would kind of an interestingly low curiosity level about other views and other perspectives and other experiences. Some passive aggressive communication, meaning kind of like one way emailing, conference talks, and that kind of thing, without really inviting any kind of like dialogue or response. And then a really interesting phenomenon which showed up was this sort of like mutual, I will say that I saw this on the part of the adult children and on the part of the parents, this mutual externalization of blame, where the adults had a tendency, the parents, had a tendency to blame, and would communicate this to their children, other sources for the disaffiliation. So, like, maybe it was because they married the wrong person, maybe it was the influence of bad friends, maybe it was they were actually under the influence of Satan. I heard all of those and more. And then on the other side of that, the kids would often blame, they would, not all of them, but some of them use the language of like a cult. They, my parents have been brainwashed. And so there was this real, like, kind of an issue of motivation bias, I think, which came up. And a simple way to explain motivation bias is just to hold the belief that, like, I am sincere and thoughtful and earnest and heartfelt in my convictions. But someone who disagrees with me obviously just hasn't thought it all the way through, or they're not as thoughtful as I am, or they're not afraid of the same things that I'm afraid of. And so it's sort of we attribute ourselves with all of these really human qualities that make our thought processes logical and sensitive and reasonable, and we fail to allow space for people who disagree with us to have a similar sort of like level of humanity, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Yes, it reminds me of something that I talk about quite frequently, and something that you brought up in your research paper, which is that tendency that when the heat is up and we feel anxious relationally, we tend to misperceive the intents and we perceive others in ways that are probably ungenerous and unfair. You also talked about the concept of othering people, that there's an in crowd or the in group, whether it be on the side of the more traditionally believing parent, and then there's anyone outside of that becomes othered or becomes an outgroup. But I appreciate your flipping the script on that and saying that also your subjects struggled also with having the generosity to believe that the parents were sincere in their attempts to try to sort of bring their children back in. So, yes, one thing that I noticed that I can't help but just bring up as we move on to the fourth point, Liz, is it's interesting that each and every one of your subjects perceived these things about their relationship with their parents. And yet, at the same time, it's interesting. We don't really know what the parents' actual experience was, but the reality of the young adults matters. When each of these young adults felt, I am conditionally lovable in my home and in my family, or when they feel they don't want to know what I'm experiencing, they are not curious, they're not engaged, they're not involved, they're grieving me as if I were dead. The fact that that is what is internalized by each of these young people is profoundly important. And I think it's especially important if you happen to be a loving parent who is listening to this and had no idea that this perhaps is what was the internal experience of your child in their process of disaffiliation. Anything you want to say to that, Liz?
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that because, it, again, like you said, I did not interview any of these parents. I don't have their perspectives. So all that we're getting is their children's perceptions and experiences. And I think that those perceptions and experiences are incredibly valid, not because they're 100% accurate. That's not the point of qualitative research ever, but because they are being honestly communicated and tenderly communicated and communicated with a lot of vulnerability. And I think someone's feeling and felt experience of anything is always valid. And we kind of get ourselves into a really treacherous sort of like non-compassionate territory when we get stuck on the facts of the story. Or did that really happen? Or did they really say that? That turns really quickly into kind of like minimizing and dismissing and missing the point of the feelings which are being communicated. So yeah, I think that's an important sort of just distinction to bring up.
It strikes me also as fascinating and interesting that, you know, if you felt the desire to do a second research project and talk to all of the disaffiliated young adults whose experience went well, I would suspect that you might find the opposite phenomenon, right? Meaning that they probably said, my parents were interested, they were empathic, they were able to honor my path, they were able to be present with me. I felt unconditionally loved and accepted as I was, who I was, in what I was doing in my life. So it's interesting to think about, and I'm just learning so much as you and I talk about this, Liz, that it has obviously less to do with the disaffiliation process itself, and it has more to do with what is internalized by the interaction between these emerging adults and young adults and their parents. And the way we handle these situations in a church that really wants to support family and create these deep bonds of love and trust and unconditional lovability, this research is profoundly important, Liz.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And that is exactly why I decided to look at it, because the church, I feel like, is in the business of family welfare. They claim that it is in the doctrine. It's, you know, it's taught in missionary discussions. One of the most appealing parts for converts, I think, is the idea of an eternal family. So like the rhetoric definitely drives this idea of like a family oriented faith. And that's why I think this information is actually important to explore.
I could not agree more. I could not agree more. It's so important. I wish that every traditionally believing parent who loves their child who has disaffiliated had the information that we are trying to share here today, because we love the families, we love these parents, we love their children, and we want families to be able to be in relationships that are infused with love and support and the ability to share life with one another independent of where and how they affiliate, which I know for some traditionally believing parents, what I'm about ready to say might sound strange, but where one affiliates is of far less importance than how one is able to be deeply connected. It's less about where you go to church and how you view God. And it's so much more about actually embodying the way God would treat their children as parents, right?
Entirely. Yep.
Let's spend a second moving on to your fourth point. This is your fourth theme that was slightly different, I thought, than the other ones, because a lot of these had to do with the adult child's perception of their interpersonal relationships with their parents. And then this theme was actually a little bit different because it had more to do with actually how the child responded to their own disaffiliation process. So I want to hand this over to you, Liz, and take it away and tell us more about this fourth theme that you found in your research.
Yeah, this fourth theme was the most surprising one. And we talked a little bit about this in a previous episode, but the idea that orthodoxy, that these right ideas can keep our children safe, I think is really appealing to parents. And what showed up for these subjects was actually an incredibly dangerous sort of vacuum of parental authority or advice or information. And so what showed up was 80% of the subjects reported some element, some aspect of actually heightened exposure to what I would consider to be pretty serious risk. Many of them, close to 80% of them, reported some degree again of unsafe sexual practices. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what that looked like. There was one young man who said that he had a girlfriend for 2 years through high school and never brought her home. His parents never met her. His family had no idea that he was seriously, he was in a serious relationship with someone. They were sexually active, never once bought condoms because he knew everybody at the grocery store and they knew his parents. And this was not uncommon. This idea of like, what are the chances you're going to bump into it, a neighbor or, your parents' friends or something at the convenience store or at the grocery store if you're there to buy condoms. And so not using condoms during sex was a pretty common experience that these teens reported. And it wasn't because they didn't know better. It's not because, but it was just the reality that, like, they would rather risk what STIs and unwanted pregnancies than this degree of like disappointing their parents or disapproval or trouble or whatever that perception was. This is further complicated. There was one young woman who, when she was 15, she was dating a boy. She knew she wasn't supposed to be dating anyone until she was 16. He sexually assaulted her on a date at one point, and she went home and cleaned up and never told anybody about it until she told me, because she perceived that she would just be in trouble for dating before she was 16, and that the messaging would be like, what did you think was going to happen? You got what you deserved. Another sort of variation of this theme, or it's not even a variation, but another troubling element of this theme, I think, is women specifically, young women, these young women and teens being blamed, or even I would say verbally abused, for consensual sexual activity. And the burden of that responsibility, the decision that had been made to have sex, being displaced wholly onto the woman, or in some cases, the girl. They were often teens. I heard from multiple women that they had heard either from their sexual partner or from a priesthood leader, sometimes both, phrases like, what were you thinking? You could have lost him everything. You could have jeopardized his mission plans. You could have lost him his temple recommend. So that's what they would hear kind of from a bishop when they went in to confess. And they would hear really similar things from their sexual partners oftentimes, that after, like the heat has sort of like died down and the regret maybe has set in, or the questions about like whether or not that was what these people really wanted, what this man really wanted, this young man, and the blame would be displaced completely onto her. So again, and this shows up a lot in purity culture and a lot around like modesty culture. I think sort of this idea that the responsibility for policing sexual activity or stopping sexual activity is always up to the woman. And I know, like, again, to get a little bit personal, that is what I heard in young women's growing up for sure. I heard that a lot, that kind of messaging that it was up to me to put the brakes on.
Wow, such a troubling, sad phenomenon that you found. And what kind of comes up for me as I'm listening to you, Liz, is because this is our fourth theme, I'm once again noticing how so many of these are sort of interconnected. Because if you think about how in a religious system where the parents of these young adults struggle themselves with taking ownership of their systems of belief, or like, what do I believe? What have I internalized about my relationship with my body or my relationship with sexuality? Because they likely didn't have that exposure or that psychological autonomy themselves. They weren't teaching their adolescents that. And then, but they were teaching their adolescents the importance of listening to whatever the church said or whatever the authorities in the church said. And then when that wasn't internalized and the youth went about exploring and moving through adolescence and young adulthood, they didn't really have a sense of sexual self or a sense of spiritual self. And further, because they didn't have any guidance and direction in terms of like how to take this in and be and make it their own. Yeah. And then they didn't feel like they had the support of parents when they made the inevitable stumbles that happen through the adolescent and young adult years. And so it brought about a great degree of hiding, evading, dangerous behavior without even having your parents to fall back on, because you felt like you might be in more trouble for being in deep water regarding the teachings of the church, and that perhaps their safety was, again, this might be oriented around the young adult's perceptions, but I get the sense from what you described that the perception was, my safety is of lesser importance than my disobedience. And therefore, I'm going to compromise my own safety because I can't tolerate what my parents will feel about me, say, for example, breaking the law of chastity. Am I right on that? Is that feeling?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100% right. That choices were made at a certain point to move in unsafe directions and like sort of tread into this deep, dangerous water where really like the stakes are very high, rather than risk losing parental approval or risk having, you know, changing, knowing that it would change the way that their parents saw them. And there were other, you know, like other just like really interesting complications of a girl who was taken, I think she was 18 or 19. I'm not certain of her age at the time of this incident. She was taken to the ER by her dad for an emergency, a medical emergency of some kind. And they asked her if she was sexually active, which was directly relevant to the medical treatment she was going to get. And she lied and said no, because she knew that her dad couldn't handle it and just went with like, oh, we'll see what happens. I hope everything's okay. There were other interesting, just a variety kind of other things that I would consider to be higher risk than they need to be. There was one subject. He was really interesting. He was, I think the only subject I interviewed who was still actively believing, actually, and completely inactive. So completely faithful internally, but not practicing because it was too hard on his mental health. But he had struggled all through high school with what he described as a pornography addiction. He had been hospitalized. He suffered from, I would say, and this is, you know, some degree of obsessive compulsive patterns. So multiple suicide attempts. He had been treated through different forms of like 12-step and LDS family services, like kind of porn addiction treatment modality. And that as a clinician to me is interesting just because there is so much data. There's really good data showing that framing pornography use as an addiction is not only not an effective way to treat it, but it is actually counterproductive. And it tends to drive the addictive cycle, actually, rather than just looking at it as this is maybe compulsive sexual behavior that doesn't align with my values. And I want to try to understand how I'm using it. What am I trying to numb? You know, that sort of like more evidence-based approach to pornography use. So I thought that was interesting too. And it's such a common experience for teen boys and men in the LDS faith that I thought that was maybe important to highlight as well.
Yes. I'm just struck by how interesting it was that all of these sort of intended ways of helping our children sometimes tend to backfire in the heat of the moment, right? Because I mean, what I'm thinking about in terms of unsafe sexual practices, I know your paper mentioned some kids that experimented with drugs. This conversation that you and I are having about this young man who was struggling with his relationship with pornography. In each and every one of these cases, this is in some ways part of the journey of an adolescent and emerging adult to learn how they relate to themselves in these very, very high risk or high cost areas, right? And so on the one hand, I mean, I see this as very complicated, Liz, because I feel like a healthy religious system and healthy parents have the potential to be really good participative guides helping their children navigate these things, well knowing that there is a high likelihood that they're going to flounder and, you know, need to figure some things out experientially, right? And that if the kids have an awareness that the system and their parents hold space for their humanity, they will run towards their parents in these moments where they realize they have acted outside of their own value system. What I notice, though, in what you're talking about, just with so much sadness, is that for at least the parents of these emerging adults, they did not have the skill set to help their children create an internalized value system about their emerging selves. But secondly, they didn't help their children recognize that if and when you flounder or struggle with that value system that you're learning how to create, we are here for you. We are here to catch you. And so neither of these things took place. And it has me wondering if perhaps it has to do somewhat with the fact that maybe I keep returning to the same topic, I guess, in my mind. So you can tell me how you feel about this, Liz. But it feels in some ways like when a parent hasn't internalized their value system, but they have consistently and throughout their life sort of handed that over to the authority figures, they may be obedient, but it doesn't actually, it's not something that they have truly owned within themselves. And so they have a really hard time working with their own children who are experimenting, who don't have their own system of internalized values, but the parents have no skill set to actually help them with that. And so it creates this great wall of disconnect between the parent and the child, probably due to mutual psychological underdevelopment, but the child also wants the approval of their parents. And so it actually seemingly forces them into the corner of deception and harm. They're squarely in harm's way.
Yeah. I think this is, you're right. This is so tricky to talk about. It's so complex. But knowing what we know, you and I are both trained therapists. We know something about human development. Knowing what we know about healthy human development, I think it's safe to assume that these parents are somewhat underdeveloped for whatever reason. And I think it's also safe to assume that people are underdeveloped for very good reason, and that it's often some form of emotional neglect, psychological neglect, perhaps trauma, and perhaps just a lack of invitation, a lack of a safe environment in which to develop. So there, I think it's important to emphasize that, like, if these parents are underdeveloped, which is what it looks like from the research, they are underdeveloped for a good reason. That underdevelopment, however, creates a vacuum, which in itself can be traumatic then for their children. So these parents, I think, are often actually probably drawn to a high demand religion, because a high demand religion will provide all of the structure and all of the guidance and all of the rules for what we do and what we do not do that they've never had the opportunity or the freedom to explore and examine and metabolize and digest and figure out for themselves, for fear of disapproval, for lack of safety in the community, or for lack of opportunity, or maybe a combination of all three of those things. So I think the fact that high demand religions retain perhaps a high proportion of somewhat anxious and somewhat underdeveloped adults is not a coincidence. And I hope that this doesn't sound harsh and judgmental. I feel, as I'm saying this, I feel a lot of compassion for these parents. I feel for the ways in which they are suffering, and I feel for the ways in which opportunities for greater development have somehow passed them by or been withheld. But I think it's important to at some point kind of name it for what it is and say it's never too late. One of the things that I'm excited to talk about as we move forward is what adult development can look like, which is so exciting. It's actually my favorite area for therapy. It's my favorite thing to work on with adults in therapy, is just, you know, like to understand what lifespan development can be.
So beautiful, Liz. And I agree with you. I think there's something really sacred and special about helping adults tap into their potential to grow. And I know I do this. This is the main thing that I do, is I work with adults mainly. Well, actually, I only work with adults, but they span the lifespan, but they are wrestling with these very topics that you and I are talking about, meaning that most people that are attracted to the Latter-day Struggles platform were historically the highest compliance, most Orthodox members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, sometimes for decades. And when they are lucky enough to have a life's experience that invites them into a faith expansion journey, oftentimes after the trauma and the crisis of it all, they are mesmerized by the beauty of the process of who they are unfolding to become and the growth potential that they never even knew was possible. And so, yes, we are going to jump into that for anyone who is listening to this, who might be noticing with a lot of vulnerability that you have had a child and that perhaps you have struggled with your emerging adult child or your young adult child who has perhaps left the faith. And just for Liz and I to offer you both love and compassion and empathy. I was not the parent of a young adult, but my husband and I were both parents of two very sassy and amazing teenage daughters who pushed and pushed and pushed. And we probably would have been fantastic. They would have been fantastic participants in your study just many years ago because we were doing all of these things, Liz. And so that's why I think I have such a soft spot in my heart for the intent of these well-meaning parents, but also for us to have the capacity to say, okay, what has happened between myself and my child? It isn't working. There's a wedge. There's something going on where I'm not feeling the closeness that I crave. And notwithstanding the fact that they have departed from, you know, the faith of their parents, I want to be close with them, and perhaps there's another way. And so that's what we're hoping this series is helping those of you out there listening better understand, either from the side of the person who has disaffiliated, or even if you haven't, but you've just shifted your views, and even the shift in the views has caused what feels like wedges and awkward silences or disconnect or distance between yourself and your loved ones, so that you can kind of better understand what the others may be feeling. And then if you're on the side of these the parents of these participants, so that you can better understand that, you know, you're not alone. You might just be normal for this population, this demographic. Hello, dear friends. As you probably know, I love creating the Latter-day Struggles podcast for you. I am so committed to providing you with frequent, honest, psychologically sound content to help you find faith, peace, confidence, and direction in your faith journey. However, I need your support. The content and the demands of this podcast have made it necessary for me to give up my previous work as a private practice therapist. As a way for you to show your support and gratitude for my work, I invite you to become a paid subscriber to this podcast, which will give you access to all of the Friday episodes. All Monday episodes will continue to be free of charge because I want you to be able to continue to know what we're exploring each week here on the podcast. So, for only $9.99 a month, you will not only continue to receive the content that has been so pivotal to your faith journey, but you can also help ensure that I can continue to serve this community. Your small cumulative contributions are already making such a difference. And also, you will be honoring the dedication, education, and commitment of a female Latter-day Saint professional who is brave enough to ask to be valued monetarily for her professional contribution to her community. Information on how to subscribe, information on how to become a monthly patron through my Patreon account, and also information on how to make a one-time donation through my professional Venmo account can all be found in my show notes at the bottom of each episode. So thank you so much for your ongoing support and trust. Now, back to the show. Okay, I want to shift gears now that we've talked about these four topics, Liz, and we are going to do a fun little exploration of some phenomenon that you brought up that you learned about. Perhaps you discovered it in the process of this research. Some of this was just mind-blowing to me because, Liz, I hadn't thought about a few of these things in quite the way that you had explained them. But when I read it, I was like, yes, this makes so much sense. So the first thing I want to talk about, Liz, is these participants in your research study felt a great deal of consternation, grief, shame around the meaning that their parents were making when they disaffiliated from the church. Now, this is directly connected to the fact that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is what we call a covenantal religion. Can you speak to that? Because I feel like that is perhaps maybe one of the most important points that helps us better understand why this is a crisis and why this is so painful between these two generations.
Yeah, I was very confused during college when my closest friend was Irish Catholic and did not understand my consternation and grief as I was exploring my own values and behaviors and trying to figure out how to be a responsible adult in a self-respecting way. And he was certain that all of my Mormon friends were going through something similar, and I was quite certain that they weren't. And now that I've done this research, maybe he was right and maybe he wasn't. But this idea of a covenantal religion actually helped me. I went back in time to like 18-year-old Liz, and my best friend Joe, and like, oh, that he's coming at religion from a very different place. So I am not a religious scholar, so just a caveat there, but I will do my best to just simply explain that a covenantal religion is understood to have elements involving direct covenants between its members, its congregations, its people, and its God. We hear about this a lot in scripture. When the people of Israel are often referred to as a covenantal people, it often involves a two-way covenant or like a bilateral covenant, which can be sort of like a mutual covenant between God and his people. And it can work in a couple of different ways. So if those people who have made the covenant are obedient and keep the covenants to God, they will receive the blessings, and that's God's covenant to them. And those who do not keep the covenants then are at risk of being cursed or punished or having the blessings withheld. I've heard, in scripture that God is bound by these covenants. If you do not do these things, you have no promise. That those words kind of like echo in my mind when I am thinking about this. So, yeah, that's sort of a quick summation of the idea of a covenantal religion and how it is different from lots of other religions which don't have that element.
It's like the stakes are infinitely higher in covenantal religions when somebody chooses to stray. And I'm using the word of the side of the covenant keeping people. This idea that we are the covenant people, we have this special chosen relationship with God, and if we make and keep these special, unique covenants with God, we receive specific blessings. But if we don't receive these blessings. And I think another piece of this that we've already sort of woven through our conversation thus far is that part of being covenantal in the Latter-day Saint strain is keeping the covenant equals connection, breaking the covenant equals isolation. And so we're talking high stakes here on a level that is. It's in, to say it's anxiety inducing is a gross understatement when we're talking about if a child's healthy individuation, self-exploration, trying to decide who am I and how do I relate to God and the world and truth and goodness, but it diverts even ever so slightly away from this specific covenant, the requirements of the covenant. What really, in my opinion, is healthy growth turns into a crisis in the family because of the constraints of the covenant. And in some ways, it's very sad and it's a setup because, like I often think about and have talked about on the Latter-day Struggles podcast, I feel like a lot of the theology of many churches really is very well intended until we see how it impacts people on the ground. The idea of this beautiful community sort of keeping these promises and going to heaven altogether. I mean, it's lovely until you infuse it with humanity. It starts to get a lot messier and a lot more painful. And it prevents people from actually having their own lived experience. In some ways, one might argue that if this really truly is the way it has to be, we might actually choose to have our loved ones lose their agency because the costs are just too darn high. I can't afford to have my child think and feel and believe and explore and expand and self-define, because if there's even the smallest chance that what that equals is them not keeping this covenant, it's too painful, it's too scary. And I think you're bringing this into your research is a really big deal, because I think this is exactly why parents couldn't live in the present. That's why they were so terrified and paralyzed. They were living the eternal isolation that was promised to them and their children because their child was becoming a self.
Yeah. And what does that mean about the parent and the parenting that that child received? I think there's some pretty specific language in LDS rhetoric about all good children will return. The pressure is working on everybody in this relationship, in this equation. Nobody's getting off the hook easily. And it's interesting, as you were talking, what was coming to me was the stories that I heard in primary about the war in heaven. And how there were two plans presented, right? Lucifer's plan was everyone gets saved, no agency, no autonomy. And that the plan presented that was chosen by Christ was agency, autonomy, exploration, freedom to like mess it all up, freedom to really blow it, and an atonement to create a way back to God. And I think in that context, and maybe I'm being reductive, and maybe I don't under, again, I'm not a religious scholar, but I think in that context, this kind of anxiety is, it doesn't make sense to me.
No, it doesn't make sense because, gosh, so many directions we could go here. But I guess I will just take a tiny bit of a segue to talk about how our understanding of God and of the nature of God and the nature of the purpose of life seems to be at the basis of our fears. Because on the one hand, if we feel, which is how I feel, which is life is about learning and growing and experiencing and coming to ourselves, and that our divine creators, our parents in heaven, however you want to call them, they are interested and engaged and supportive of the journey. Now, if that truly is the theology, then that is inclusive of human beings having all sorts of autonomy and agency because there's only one way to learn and grow, right? And so on the flip side of that, you have covenantal relationship, which makes it scary to learn and grow. It makes it scary to become a self. It makes it scary to decide how one believes. Because the interesting thing here, Liz, is that covenantal relationships, tell me if you, I could be wrong on this. I'm just, you're pressuring my thoughts here, but covenantal relationships isn't even always as much about what one does, but it's actually as much about what one believes. And so someone may not even be diverting from certain ways of moving about in the world, they may just believe wrong. Right? So I guess where I, the way I'm going to link this to our larger conversation of these kids, these adult kids and their parents. Many of these young adults very likely disaffiliated, but are probably still living a very similar value system or you know, close to it, right? With some minor diversions. But they're probably in essence mostly the same person. But to their parents, because they are not making and keeping temple covenants, their salvation is equally lost. It's not even as much about compliance. It's as much about what you believe. It's about ideas. You can be lost from your parents and eternally isolated because you don't have the right ideas. And then it becomes the parents' mandated responsibility per all sorts of church correlated resources that they have to bring those kids back in. That, and if they don't, they are losing their salvation of their children, and it's their responsibility, and they have to really feel a lot of pressure. You came up with some of these, and I came up with some of these, but some of the verbiage that's commonly used for those who disaffiliate, these are the words that may come to the minds of grieving parents about their own children: careless, disobedient, wayward, troublesome, worldly, prodigal, lazy, lax, lost soul, black sheep. I mean, whoa, this is verbal abuse right here. And so, if you think about a parent with the pressure to save their child, because that is sort of synonymous with being a good parent, right? If you're a good Mormon parent, you want to really push them through the program. And if you don't, oftentimes you don't even blame your kid, you blame yourself. And then what it turns into is strong arming and trying to really bring them back. And oftentimes in situations of this nature, the end justifies the means. And if I can just somehow get that kid back in line, then it almost doesn't even matter how I do it because I'm so terrified about losing them because of this covenantal relationship that I'm so firmly in, you know, embedded in.
This list of language is so upsetting to me. And it was upsetting to all of the subjects in my study. And I think there are certainly people that are going to be listening that are, oh, we would never say that to anybody who's left. Well, guess what? Those kids all grew up going to church for years. They've already heard it. They remember it. They know how they're being talked about and how they're being discussed. And talk about like the motivation bias coming back, right? That like this is what they're reduced to. I think there's like this fundamental misunderstanding and misattribution of all these negative characteristics, which are essentially like a total lack of character, a lack of goodness, a lack of care. This negative language is so dehumanizing, judgmental, it's shaming, like you said, it's abusive. And critically, I think it leaves the disaffiliating person with absolutely no dignity. It's not loving, it's not respectful. If we want to be more loving, I think it can help to operationalize the idea of love, which is another research nerd term. But to sort of like, what do we mean when we say love? People talk about love in all kinds of ways. One of my favorite thinkers and writers and humans is bell hooks, who was an author who's just lovely and brilliant. And she has really good words to describe love. She has this handful of words that she throws around a lot in her research, which actually was for her career at Stanford, all about love. The characteristics that she uses to define love are these. And I just want to sort of compare and contrast like this list of attributes and words to what we just heard. The words that she talks about are care, affection, recognition, respect, commitment, trust, and open communication. And I think if part of the mission of the church is to help humans reach their full capacity and become more godlike, which is a really cool and kind of uniquely Mormon aspect of theology, that like humans have the capacity to become gods, then it makes sense that developing our capacity to be more loving is actually requisite and fundamental to this work. And I think if the church is going to be more loving, then it's incumbent upon the members to learn to let others, including those who are choosing to disaffiliate, be the experts on their own lives and on their own experiences, and create space for others to navigate their own path with total dignity and with all of their humanity intact.
Absolutely. Man, I want us to do better as a church, because we talk about, I grew up in the era where we were the family church. We're the church where people are attracted to us because we have such strong family values. And right now I feel like it is such an important time to really stand by that very thing. If we truly value the family, we need to help generations inside of the homes of these families learn how to love each other better, learn how to be more compassionate, curious, open, willing to hear what each other's experiences are. And I feel like this covenantal relationship, this covenantal religion idea, the theology around being in a covenant, I wonder if it that needs to be looked at really hard so that families can recognize that perhaps that very theology, while intending to be bonding, is actually creating huge rifts in family systems. Because if we can accept that perhaps what we're here for is to learn how to love, and that is really the only promise that, needs keeping, like that, let's learn how to love one another. And that we as a family and we as a collective, God's children, can return back to God using this life as an opportunity to learn how to love. That's a covenant I can get behind. But when we use language around covenants or ideas around covenants in a way that is actually corrosive to love, we really need to look at the theology that undergirds that kind of idea.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think maybe it's important to emphasize that covenantal religions are almost always high demand religions. And if we want to talk about what that means, it means you can identify a high demand religion by the ways that they reach into people's everyday lives. They inform what the members, like really material decisions. What are you going to wear? What are you going to eat? How are you going to spend your time? And then obviously there are more religious elements, like how do you worship? What are the rituals? What are the stages of life that you're sort, and the rituals that are ascribed to those stages of life. But what that does when we have these external rituals and kind of these observable behaviors in a high demand religion or a covenantal religion, it creates a lot of outward manifestations of how faithful someone is or is not. And it can really set up a lot of sort of like policing, a lot of judging, the idea of, oh my gosh, like let's back up to the idea of a covenant. If I'm righteous, I'm going to be blessed. Let's think about all of the ways that that can be kind of like tweaked and misconstrued into a prosperity gospel, which means if I'm rich, that means I'm righteous, which is really troubling to contemplate. And then how does that inform how the religious or the faithful or these Orthodox people who are within the covenant are looking at people who are struggling or suffering? I think that is a real problem because it sets up this, yeah, this kind of like policing within the community and this almost permission. It's not permission, it's almost permission to judge someone who's suddenly ill or who loses their wealth or, as the subjects in the study were experiencing, just kind of everyday trials of career problems or financial difficulties, relationship struggles, those kinds of things, just everyday, human life reality, and setting it up as a, well, what did you think was going to happen when you left the church? This is obviously God's punishment. He's withholding blessings because you are sinful, as if people who are faithful don't experience hardship. And I think like that is really off-putting to me.
It's like it creates the temptation to make a one-to-one correlation on anything that good is happening to good people, anything that is bad is happening to bad people. It's easy to fall into if you happen to be somebody who is having a little bit of a smooth ride in your life. But inevitably that falls apart because we all know that all sorts of, life happens to every human being that experiences life. And so what it actually does in some ways is it creates a paradigm that is bound to disillusion people when inevitably they experience humanity. And oftentimes, what it does is it turns into a backfire where people feel betrayed by God. And so it's tricky. Let me ask you one question as we close up this episode, Liz. I'm trying to make sense of what can a covenantal religion look like on a good day, right? We talked about these participants that had these strained relationships with their parents, but we also want to keep on the forefront the fact that a lot of these disaffiliate, a lot of people can disaffiliate and can have a positive and an empathic experience with their parents. This is not what this research project is about, but you stated that explicitly in your limitations of this research project. So help me understand the connection between families that do better in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or you could even say in Judaism, because they're also a covenant religion. And so they're going to have their own disaffiliation experiences between generations. What might this look like if it went well, even inside of a covenantal religion? Any thoughts on that, Liz?
I mean, my thoughts are that it is a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask to let go of the need for control. Humans are really good at certainty. The human brain, it likes to snap into black and white thinking. It's comfortable, it's easy. We like to know exactly as much as we can, right? With certainty. The human brain hates ambiguity, hates paradox, hates, like, we're not naturally wired. We're not wired for that. And I think there are really good reasons for that. Anxiety has kept us safe and evolving and alive as a species for, thousands of years. So I think optimism and faith maybe haven't. They, like looking forward with faith, being optimistic, trusting, coming back to the present moment, those are not particularly adaptive in terms of our species survival. So there's a reason that we feel anxious. And when we feel anxious, we want to go into certainty and we want to go into control. So, I guess on a good day, at its best, this idea of a covenantal religion would be so personal. So personal between one individual and their God. If that God is worthy of this covenant, It would hopefully set that individual free from the need to control, from all of that anxiety, and give them the grace that they can then pass along to their loved ones with the knowledge of this loving God that they have covenanted to, and that that God will figure this out. That all, if this God is as big and capacious as I believe this God is, there's space for all of these individuals to have their own relationship with whatever they determine God to be, and for God to hold space for that. I think we as humans are not great at holding space for that, but I have no doubt that whatever God is can pull that off.
As you were speaking, what kind of occurred to me is that even someone who really cleaves to those covenant ideas and and it works for them and they really, really feel strongly about that. I have firsthand experience with just actually recently in the last couple of weeks with someone who will both holds tightly to the idea of the covenantal religion. And I know we always talk about the covenant path. That's very relevant in this conversation. And yet, at the same time, probably outside of their own consciousness, had already practiced a great deal of surrender. Because in this interesting conversation I had with this individual who has a queer child, but has a remarkably beautiful relationship with this child, I said to them, "You know, your child's going to be in heaven with you wherever you are. Am I wrong?" And they said, "Of course she is." And I said, "I thought you knew that." And it was so cute. I kind of chuckled inside because this person's holding a great paradox. Because on the one hand, the covenant path that they are advocating for, with all their heart, says one thing. And yet, inside of their own heart, as a parent, they also knew the opposite to be true. And so I guess as we wrestle this out together, the idea comes to me that perhaps on a good day, an individual can both hold space for the idea of a covenant, but also recognize that maybe it's not as binding on the ground as perhaps the handbooks actually talk about. And maybe that's how they're holding both a little bit.
Yeah, I've been really fascinated to work with very faithful, very believing members who are holding similar paradox as their children, as they create space for their children to differentiate and explore and be themselves. And it is, I've heard almost those exact words, "Of course I know. Of course I know that they're going to be there with me." And I love that capacity for the nuance and the paradox and all of it and the bigness of it. And that to me looks like adult development. That is a parent who is functioning as an adult, who is functioning as a grown-up in their own life and saying, "I have this relationship to this God who I have come to know, and I know better than to think that this God would withhold love, salvation, whatever the blessings in the covenant are, from this child who is perfect."
What it brings up in my mind, Liz, is that we as individuals are inevitably growing and individuating and becoming probably healthier at a quicker rate than these mammoth religious systems. And I think that's how religious systems ultimately evolve themselves. It feels like it's at a snail's pace, but it's because they're what grows is a critical mass of individuals, just exactly as we're describing, that says, "I know the church says this, but what I've come to learn in my heart through my own lived experience is this." And that population's sort of holding space for both, probably in a way that's somewhat uncomfortable. There's probably some cognitive dissonance going on there, probably. And yet at the same time, they're allowing themselves to sit in this discomfort because for their own reasons, they value the tradition, they value the structure, they value the rules, they value the laws or whatever. And they also see that love will always supersede the law. I think it's a good time. This is perfect time to end this episode. And next episode, our final episode, we are going to do something really fun. We're shifting gears just a tiny little bit. We are going to pivot just a little bit and plug in all of these amazing learnings that Liz has been sharing with us into a psychological model. So, Liz, will you just give everyone a little tiny bit of a forecast for things to come on Friday? What is it that we're going to be talking about?
Yes, I'm so excited. We are going to be talking about Erik Erikson's framework for identity development. He refers to this as a psychosocial model of identity development. And this model is a fun one. It's old, but it is classic for a reason. People have added a lot of good things to it in the, 50 plus years since he developed it. But I think it still holds a lot of water, just knowing what we know. About how personalities form, how identities solidify in sort of one direction or another, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I'm really excited to talk about that with you.
Yes, we are going to use this model and plug it into the psychosocial development of the Latter-day Saint child through, well, beginning in childhood and moving clear on through adulthood, and talk a little bit about how these emerging adults and their parents are manifesting in various and interesting ways that the model will help us better understand. So much more to come on that next time. If those of you who have listened to this have benefited, please, please, please share this podcast episode with your friends and family. Liz and I have taken special care to present this in such a way that we really want your more traditionally believing Latter-day Saint friends and family to listen to this, because we care so much about helping our families heal. And we love you all. We want us to be a healthy faith tradition. If this is something that is valuable, please send that on to your friends and family. Also, if you are benefiting from this podcast and you would like to pause for just a moment and rate and review this podcast, it's incredibly important that people that are coming onto the scene of faith expansion see that this is a valuable and a credible source for your growth and development. And if there's anything that I can do to serve you through my platform, please jump over to latterdaystruggles.com, where you can find a variety of offerings. Incidentally, right now I am in the thick of actually teaching a variety of classes complete with digital workbooks on these very topics around becoming healthy parents in and around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So if you want to jump into any one of these three series, that some are recorded and some are live, just depending on when you catch them, and you want to know more about how to do this on the ground, including live question and answer sessions from me, please go to latterdaystruggles.com and enroll right now. So, thank you all for being here, and we will see you next time.
Dialogue Podcast Network.